This is Night Call. Broadcast live with host Russ Gibb. And tonight's guest, Mr. John Genzel of New York City. Tonight's subject, are Protestant churches sterile? You participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Now here's Night Call host, Russ Gibb.
Hello, night people. This is Gibb. Standing by in New York City is Reverend John Genzel, a missionary to the jazz community of New York City, and a man who has experimented with many new forms of worship. If you would like to ask Reverend Genzel a question or make a comment on tonight's topic, Are Protestant Church Services Sterile, give us a call here at our national night call number. The number to call is area code 313-846-6601. Dial us direct. If you wish, you may make the call collect. The lines are now open. Please make that call station to station. The number, area code, 313-846-6601. John, do you believe that today's Protestant church services are sterile?
Well, Russ, I do believe that there are many worship services that are sterile. Of course, I haven't heard all of them, so I can't make a blanket commitment saying, yes, they're all sterile. But I believe that many of them are, Russ. Sterility has to do with the fact that there's not too much productivity. And by the very fact that there are many people who can easily bypass the church, whether they're members or not, and by the very fact that even after a worship service, people cannot even sing the melody of either some of the hymns or the liturgical service, indicates that there's something that is bypassing the people, that they're not involved in the service, they're kind of going through it.
Well, what would you say is the biggest problem with the services today?
Well, I think that one of the very biggest problems with the services today, Russ, is the very fact that they're not very easily understood, that the people can be in the service, but in a sense not know what's going on. For instance, in this whole concept of the renewal of the church, in this renewal of the church, one of the things is that, for instance, the Roman Catholic Church is trying to do is to try to make the worship service intelligible to the people in the pew. In fact, they're changing much of the service, so it's from Latin to the vernacular of the day. And I feel that this is it's obtuse, it's thick, it's not easily understood by the people. They don't know what they're doing.
In other words, are you saying that many ministers are talking over the heads of their parishioners?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's very easy, Russ, to get into a jargon, into a particular language of the thing that you're doing. I don't care what profession a person is in, they talk in that specific language. And I've noticed myself oftentimes in preaching that something that I understand pretty well, oftentimes the people in the pew do not understand. They tell me, say, well, Pastor, you've kind of... You're talking about something which you may be familiar with, but which isn't familiar to us. And I do think that oftentimes preachers do this.
Well, now, you're a missionary to the jazz community of New York City. Certainly, you should be able to speak the language of the average individual. You shouldn't have this problem, should you?
Yeah.
And yet you say you do have it.
Yes. Well, I think that I can speak the language of the average individual, and the very fact that I am involved in this very thing, and I'm constantly thinking about communicating to other people, makes me conscious of the fact that so often I precisely do what I said before, is use language which is familiar to the profession, so to speak, but which may not be familiar to the person of you, or perhaps by the very fact that we are accustomed to using certain phrases as a pastor, they become not intelligible to the people simply because you use them over again, like
a cliche. Then,
yeah, cliche, the blood of the lamb, we think that I might understand it, but the person out there in the pew by hearing it maybe so often does not think about it, you know, specifically.
All right, we've talked a little bit about the actual sermon, the use of words. What about music in the church? Do you think we're getting across with the traditional music?
Well, here again, I think that Well, again, I think, Russ, that I have to be very careful. I'm a Lutheran, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And our worship service is quite liturgical. The Episcopal Church service is quite liturgical. The Roman Catholic Church is quite liturgical. And so, therefore, when I talk about church music, I have to be careful because I'm thinking usually of our particular service. And as we know, there is such a variety of worship throughout many churches that when I speak about the particular service, I'm speaking only about a part of it. But the music in, for instance, the chanting in the service and the liturgical music oftentimes is kind of on a horizontal level.
Now, what do you mean horizontal?
Well, I mean that it doesn't have too much of the mountaintop and the valley experience, the perpendicular aspect of it, up and down, and also it isn't very rhythmical for the most part.
And church music doesn't have rhythm, is what you're
saying.
Well,
it doesn't have rhythm or too much swing, you know.
It doesn't have a beat.
It doesn't have a beat, now.
All right, should it have a beat?
Well, I think that insofar as the fact that we are made rhythmically, Russ, we walk that way. You walk with someone down the street, and unless you take a very, very long stride, and the person takes a very short stride, there will be the chance that you will soon fall in step and swing together. Your heartbeat is rhythmical. You breathe in rhythm for the most part. And why we cannot carry this very natural function into the church is beyond me. Duke Ellington, you know, is in San Francisco now, and on the 16th of this month, he is going to do a worship service in Grace Cathedral in San Francisco under the commissioning of Bishop Pike, who is quite a controversial figure in this our day. And he was asked about, he said, are you going to have the music swing? And Duke said something to the effect, well, when your pulse beats with mine, man, we're swinging, you know.
Now, wouldn't a lot of people criticize this and say this is not traditional, that it is undignified to have this type of music in a church?
Yeah. Well, I think that it is true that some people would say that it's not traditional, but we mustn't equate that which is not traditional, we must not equate it with the fact that then, therefore, it's not dignified. Because I am not accustomed to doing something, and because something is done in a different manner in the way that I do them, that doesn't mean that, therefore, it's undignified. Certainly, it isn't traditional in many churches to have rhythmic music. In many churches it is. Much of, for instance, of jazz and the beat of it began in a sense in the church. So in many churches there is the beat and the swing.
We but tend
in,
to think
in
of this
of our traditional churches it isn't the customary thing to do, and precisely when you get the new, then, of course, many people say, well, look, we didn't do it that way before, and therefore there's something must be wrong with it, and I'm against it, and I don't go with it.
We tend to think that the Negro has a lot of rhythm in his church service. Would you suggest that we Africanize today's Protestant services?
Well, it depends. I think we have to be careful that we don't equate the fact, in other words, if a Negro is a Lutheran or a Roman Catholic, or Episcopalian, the chances are he's not going to have too much of this in the church, you know.
Right.
It's according to his particular faith, not because he's a Negro that he has that he might be rhythmical. But I do think, again, that it certainly is very proper to have the idea of the beat in the service. Music, after all, the first instrument, no doubt, in music was the drum and the beat. And it's very natural because, again, it goes along with the heartbeat. And when you talk about the heart, you're talking about the very essence of life. You say about a person, he has heart, you know. That means that he has a deep feeling for the essence of the situation. And again, I feel definitely that the idea of the rhythm is certainly not at all sacrilegious in the service.
Where did we get the idea that we have to have a very staid type music in the church?
Well, I think that at the beginning, back in the through Ambrose and some of the other ancient fathers, the plain song and the chant, the Gregorian chant, developed, and it developed along this particular line of the idea of peace, for instance, usually when you talk about peace in the church, you lower your voice and you're speaking softly and so forth. And this idea of, as I said before, this horizontal sort of aspect went along with the concept of the spirituality of the church. It is not mundane. It has not to do with the world. It's something that is set apart. It's what we call that which is objective and not too subjective. And if you think along this particular line in which I'm now speaking, in fact, I'm waving my hands kind of in front of me in a circular motion, you kind of get along with this idea of something that is away from that which has to do with the common stuff of life and so on, and you kind of get away in the cathedral monastic sort of system, you know.
Our guest tonight, Reverend John Gensel. Our topic, our Protestant church services sterile. You're tuned to the Night Call Network. This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
Hello, I'm Sherry Lewis. But today I'm not going to talk about Lamb Chop or Charlie Horse. I want to talk about real children. Children who have arthritis. Sounds impossible, doesn't it? We always seem to think arthritis only attacks older people. But listen.
We never gave it a thought of arthritis, being that the child was so young. Because whoever figured a baby would come up with arthritis.
My cat says meow. My dog says bow wow. Oh, listen. They're both talking now.
Well, there you have it. The reason why all of us must support medical research. Vital research that will someday bring a cure. And that's why I'm asking you to give. And give all you can to your Arthritis Foundation. For care today, for a cure tomorrow.
This is Night Call. And here is host, Russ Gibb. Our topic tonight, our Protestant church services sterile. Our guest, Reverend John Gensel, who is a missionary to the jazz community of New York City. If you'd like to ask Reverend Gensel a question or make a comment about the church services, the Protestant church services, give us a call here at Night Call. The number to call is area code 313-846-6601. Our operator is now on duty. We're accepting calls. Now remember, you may call from anywhere collect. Please make the call station to station. The number is area code 313-846-6601. Call us and let us know what you're thinking about. Reverend Gensel, if I remember correctly, it seems to me that Luther, didn't he take a tavern song or some type of beer-drinking song and make it into a hymn?
Well, Martin Luther did take some of the songs that were common from the day, the folk songs, and what he did was to take these, what we call secular songs, and apply them to the Christian witness. And this is not at all uncommon. There were a number of hymns in the history of the church that were taken right from the bar room, in a sense, and put to music. For instance, one of them, it isn't Martin Luther's, but it's one that's so familiar to all of us, the tune Greensleeves, which is now one of the Christmas carols in the hymn book of our church.
Would that have been as revolutionary in his day as saying putting a jazz band into the church today, or
well,
singing rock and roll?
In some aspects, it was, although this seemed to have been done quite a bit. In fact, in the early centuries, or not in the very early centuries, but once during the history of the church, it became such a tremendous thing to do, this particular aspect of the secularity of the church, that it almost got out of order. For instance, there were many complaints along this line, because not only were the secular tunes used of that particular day, back in about the 14th century, but even the secular words were used, and different sets of words, for instance, were sung simultaneously. And the words were so flowing and so florid that the whole thing was lost in a maze of ornamentation. And the whole thing was completely incomprehensible. For instance, to put it in today's language, can you imagine a solemn high mass sung to the tune of Old Susanna?
No, pretty difficult.
With the tenors crooning Kiss Me Again and the basses growling Asleep in the Deep.
Now, that sounds pretty wild.
Well,
you know, I might go down to hear something like that.
This is the sort of thing that we might still hear if in the Reformation of the Church, a conscientious pope had not done something about it. And it was the great Palestrini, who took his name from the town in which he was born, that came along and set things right again. So there was this great tendency.
Now, what do you mean, set things right?
Well, his what he began to do was, in a sense, in this particular sense, the music was, the traditional plain song was so much set aside that the concept of the music of the world of that time, you know, outside of the church, took over to such an extent that the music became, just completely out of hand in the sense of any dignity to it at all. In other words, it was just a reversal of what we're talking about now, where we're, in a sense, trying to, in some way, get some of the what we call the worldly music into the church. And Palestrini dedicated his music. He was a choir boy, and he became the organist choir master of the Julian Chapel in Rome. And he was such a tremendous musician that he began to dedicate and to write much of his music for the church, and it was so marvelous that in a sense the music became in that particular time a little more proper and with clear meaning.
Are we still worshiping in the 18th century? I mean, via the traditions of the 18th century?
I'm afraid that we are, Russ, to a great extent. In fact, this is a great danger to be so much in the past that we have a tendency not to use the contemporary music of today. For instance, in many of our hymnals, we don't have many industrial songs. We do not have many songs that have to do with the city. Many of our songs are pastoral.
Yes, they're always bringing in the wheat or something, aren't they?
Yeah, and the forest and so forth. And many of us, although we know what trees are, and we know about the countryside and so forth, this is not the context of our living. Here in New York City, for instance, right now I'm speaking from 11 stories, you know, I'm on the 11th floor of our home here, 215 West 98th Street in Manhattan, and there aren't too many trees right around.
Yes, I can appreciate that
and,
in New York.
So that many of the songs have to do with a scene that has already been passed.
Reverend, you ever been down to Coney Island, the beach, on a Sunday morning?
Along there quite a bit, yes.
All right. Now, you're saying that we are worshiping, in many respects, in the 18th century, that our church services are like this. Mm-hmm. Could this be why there are so many people Sunday morning, instead of being in church, are down on the beach having a good time and listening to rock and roll or whatever type of music they like on their radios?
Well, I think you've touched upon something here, Russ, which is so very important, and I almost hesitate to use the word because those of us who are preachers and the church is so full of this particular word, and that is the relevance of the church. But we're talking about this so much because many of us are very much concerned about the fact that the church is not relevant to today in some aspect. That
it's not talking the language of the average guy. Is that what you're saying?
The fellow on the street. And we must realize that the Greek that was first used, or the language, whether it was Aramaic that Jesus used, and the Greek of the early disciples must have been the language of the marketplace, the common language of the people.
Would Jesus have used slang in his day, do you think?
Well, I think that he may have used slang. If he could make his point more clearly by using slang, I think that he probably would have used it.
Well, why don't preachers...
The point was to communicate and not simply to make something so abstruse and so difficult that the people could understand. Jesus must have spoken very definitely the language of the people. This doesn't mean that he did not have dignity or didn't speak with that great sense of dignity. But, you know, even now, you see, we're talking about this, we're trying to defend Jesus, in a sense, because he may have been too much of the world, and yet he was accused of eating with sinners and involving himself with the very stuff of the common stuff of life, you know.
But we don't think of this today in the sense of our services. We want our services, don't we, to be very dignified. Don't most people prefer services like this?
Yes, and I think if there isn't anything wrong with having the service dignified, it depends what we mean by dignity. If we mean that we cannot, in a church service, involve ourselves in the thinking of the common stuff of life, if it means by dignity that we must get our mind away from the kitchen, we must get our mind away from the factory, we must get our mind away from the play, and in a sense withdraw from the world in worship, if we mean that this is dignity, and that by thinking precisely of my involvement in the total of life of, and God in my life by coming out of the world, then of course I would say that that dignity is necessary to withdraw from the world, you see.
On Sunday morning, a lot of guys go out to the golf links, and they commune. They seem to be communing. They're doing something.
Yeah.
Why aren't they in church? I want an answer out of you on this one, because I don't think you've really answered me.
I think that the reason that they enjoy playing golf a lot more than coming to church, it depends, too, what the church means. They may not, again, the whole concept of the church and the gathered community.
Now, what? There's a wonderful term. That sounds awful churchy. What is the gathered community?
Well, in a sense, I think that we can't bend over so far that we, again, lose the concept of the fact that there are many people who do feel, who believe in the Lord and believe that the church is the body of Christ in the sense that he established the church, and it is important for us to get together to communicate and to worship him and to sing praises unto him and to become a part of the fellowship. There are many people, of course, who say, well, this is for the birds, this isn't for me, this idea just doesn't touch me at all. And maybe Saturday about the only days that I have where I can get out, and so therefore, rather than going to church where it's stuffy and maybe hearing a stuffy sermon, and I'd much rather get my golf clubs and go out on the golf.
Now, well, are these people being non-Christian when they don't go to church then?
Well, it depends again what a person might mean by non-Christian. I do believe that the person, for instance, who says that he believes in Jesus Christ, who says that he is a part of the church, of the gathered community, that by his commitment, depending upon the particular commitment that is asked of people who join a specific church, by his commitment, I feel that certainly he should take time in to meet with his fellow men in worship. That doesn't say that a person cannot miss church once in a while, and some do, but the person who is a part of the church and the part of the church's mandate is to gather together, then I feel that if he possibly can, he should be with his fellow Christians to worship the Lord at least one day out of the week or 1 hour out of the week.
All right.
Yeah.
We go along with this idea, but obviously the church isn't doing this today because so many young people aren't going into church.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that we're living in an age, Russ, where we encourage questioning. For instance, we have three children. And years ago, when I was a young fellow, there was not at the table, for instance, the tremendous openness that we have. The atmosphere in our home here is the idea of, well, if you wish to ask a question or express your opinion, you go right ahead.
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend of mine from Europe recently visit us, and my younger son, who's 13, said something. Oh, he said, Dad, you're all wet. And he thought, boy, I never spoke that way to my father, you know. And he wasn't criticizing this relationship that we had, but he was saying, this isn't just what's being done. And I feel that this very questioning attitude, which I think in itself is okay, has opened up many, many doors, and there's a whole atmosphere of questioning that everything, father, mother, institutions, per se, I feel there's a great feeling against that, which is institutionalized. And therefore, it's the idea of kicking the traces, and just because that earth mother believe it or because it's the church that says it, that doesn't say that I have to accept it. So there's this rebellious spirit, and the very fact that we, in many aspects of today's contemporary society.
Our guest tonight, Reverend John Gensel. Our topic, are Protestant church services sterile? You're tuned to the Night Call Network. This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
I was driving along. Well, this other guy comes up behind me and he starts riding my bumper. I have to make this turn, so I put on the brakes and he slams right into me. There's nothing I could do about it. You're trying to make a turn.
Nothing you could do about it? Nonsense. Maybe you can't stop careless or reckless drivers, but there's absolutely no reason why you can't watch out for them. You can defend yourself by staying out of their way. Yes, you can. Listen, when another driver tailgates your car, don't speed up. That just increases the danger. Slow down a little. Leave him plenty of time to pass you and go on his way. Now, that sounds simple, but believe me, it works. Now, some people call this sort of thing defensive driving. It's really just good common sense. After all, nearly half the drivers involved in fatal collisions are good drivers and in the right. But being in the right is not enough. You could be dead right. So watch out for the other guy.
This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb. Hello again, Night People. Our guest tonight, Reverend John Gensel. He is a missionary to the jazz community of New York City, and our topic, are Protestant church services sterile? If you'd like to join us here at Night Call, our lines are now open, and you may give us a buzz. The number to call is area code 313-846-6601. Now, you may call from anywhere collect. Please make the call station to station. The number is area code 313-846-6601. The lines are now open and the operator is on duty, and we'd like to hear from you. Area code 313-846-6601. John, just before we took the break here, you said something to the effect that many churches have response-type readings in them where, you have a formalized church service. Now, in this type of response reading where you have a book in front of you and you read a sentence and then the preacher reads a sentence and you go back and forth, that sort of traditional-type...
The sterility of the service comes in, Russ, because it's all written down. Now, a person, for instance, a fellow who is visiting his girlfriend...
Doesn't write everything down.
Doesn't write everything down. And when he says to his girlfriend, honey, I love you, and do you love me, he may not get the same answer all the time, you know.
Right.
He might say, look, fella, I'm sick and tired of you. Why don't you get going? In the service, so everything is right there, back and forth. And
well, why don't we have this in our church services today? Why can't I raise up my hand during church and say, I want to ask a question?
Now, you're talking about something here which is a very important aspect of jazz. It's one of the great characteristics of jazz, that is improvisation. One of the reasons I feel that our services are sterile is because there is no opportunity for improvisation. And the word liturgy means the work of the people. And if the liturgy of the church, and here we're speaking about specifically about the form of the worship service, if within that particular structure there is no part for improvisation, we really, in a sense, get a false concept of life. For instance, if I come to church, I know we're going to start with, the prelude, the organist, then we're going to go ahead with invocation and so forth. And I know where we're going to begin,
right,
where we're going to end.
They run the same show every Sunday.
Same show every Sunday, right. No variations on the theme. Now, life isn't like this. We know very well that we have plans, you know. We're going to do this tomorrow, and lo and behold, we find that we can't do it tomorrow because suddenly a loved one of ours gets sick, or there's an accident, or something comes in. And then we have to improvise. We had all these plans, but it rains, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly the whole situation has changed. The Betsy is now playing havoc along the Gulf Coast. These people had plans a month ago that are completely going awry because the whole thing has changed. I feel that in some way the church service should reflect this. And this is one of the wonderful aspects of jazz. There's improvisation where the theme is stated. It's like the sonata form. And then the individual musicians, work upon the theme and ornate it and work around it and use the chord patterns they want to. Then they come back and restate the theme once again in the end. And I feel that in some way, if in the church service we had a little bit more of this improvisatory character, it would be truer to life and would liven the thing where you could raise your hand. I've gone to some church services where, for instance, in the East Harlem Protestant Parish, where the people get up and they say, well, I'd like to have you pray for this. I was there one time when a little girl got up and said, I have IV poison, please pray that this is taken away from me. Where there was a chance for the congregation to actually participate in a way which wasn't stilted and stated, you know.
Well, Reverend Gensel, we now have a caller from Baltimore, Maryland, a listener on WBAL.
Yes.
Miss Elizabeth Taylor. And I wonder if that's the original Elizabeth Taylor.
Well, I didn't expect to get a call from her tonight.
Hello, Elizabeth. Speak right up. You're on night call, ma'am.
Thank you.
Can you speak up, please?
Yes.
Your comment.
I'm a Methodist by faith, and the church that I belong to is having difficulty changing the format because of the ones the minister himself calls the saints. The older generation cannot accept change. The moment he changes the format the slightest little bit, they're down his collar.
Mm-hmm.
Does the Reverend have any suggestions along this line?
Well, maybe he better take his collar off so they can't get his finger in there so well. But of course, as you know, Miss Taylor, this has always been the case. Now, talking about the Methodist Church, here, about a month and a half ago, Joe Newman, who was with Count Basie for many, many years, a wonderful trumpet player, and Roger Kellaway, marvelous piano player, and I, we have composed a worship service in the jazz idiom. And we were invited to go to the old Boston Methodist Church in Boston and have this worship service at a Methodist conference. And Mr. Ellis, who is the head, Howard Ellis, of Unconventional Evangelism.
Mm-hmm.
He has his headquarters in Nashville. Unconventional Evangelism was there, and we had this worship service in the Methodist Church, and the response was very, very positive. The thing is that a minister someday just has to kind of go ahead, kind of, as we say, go straight ahead, you know, let the chips fall where they may, in a sense, and try to do something. But here again, now, I would suggest this, that the pastor, in some way, has to lead the people somehow, rather than simply flood them with something new. But this is a perennial problem, and somehow the pastor has to kind of be brave and bold and have the support of people like you, for instance, who might be along with him and have some and give the pastor some encouragement and actually discuss the situation with the people who may be against it, you know.
Elizabeth, do you think that the Protestant church services are sterile? And how does he accomplish this?
Well, for instance, the subject for this coming Sunday's sermon is the church can learn from AA.
From the...
He's going to be insulted.
From what?
The church can learn from AA.
Oh, the Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yes.
Oh, marvelous, yes.
So that he's going to be stepping on toes and rubbing furs the wrong way and so forth. But to me, this is delightful because I work very closely with Alcoholics Anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be, for me, you know, sort of
yes.
Right up my alley. But I know that some of the saints are going to be
yes.
Horrified.
Yes, yes. Well, Elizabeth, I'm so glad to hear you say that because I have done a lot of work with AA. And one of the things I say when I'm asked to speak at an open meeting, you know, is that I'm John Gensel, and I'm a dry alcoholic. I don't happen to drink, but my thinking is thinking sometimes, and my thinking goes along with thinking of many alcoholics. I don't escape in that way. And I feel that if some of the people will learn a great deal from the 12 steps and from the whole tradition of the AA.
If I could just get some of the saints to come out to some of my AA meetings.
Yes.
They would learn,
yes.
To unbend a little, I think.
I think so, too. But I think that this is excellent what you're doing. Incidentally, on August the 22nd, we had a worship service, the same O Sing Unto the Lord, a new song, this worship service I mentioned to you,
uh-huh.
in the Jazz Idiom. In a Lutheran church, Luther Place Church in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
And we had it at the holy hour, 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, and the place was jammed, and we had a very good response, generally speaking.
Elizabeth, I want to thank you for your comments.
Yes, thank you. I hope that church will open up a little bit.
I hope so, too.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth.
Good night. Elizabeth Taylor calling from Baltimore, Maryland, a listener on WBAL. Reverend, it seems to me that basically the church has been set up, the church service has been set up to go for the family unit. We tend to think that families that pray together stay together. That's a nice cliche.
It's nice if you have that to begin with. It's no longer true.
Yeah, well, this is what it seems to me, that maybe Ma and Dad paddle out to Sunday morning service, but Junior is either sacked out or he's hopped on his Honda and is beating it out to the beach. I keep going back to this.
Yeah.
Now, don't we have a responsibility to minister to these people?
Yes, you know that, again, one of the things that we're thinking about a great deal, Russ, is the fact, the truth of the fact that we live where we don't live anymore. In other words, for instance, Dick, here in New York, and this is true of many of the larger cities, that people live in suburbia and they commute to town. That means they sleep out there, but they spend an hour coming in, 8 hours here, another hour going back, it's 10 hours already, they get home, and as you say, the teenager is out in a school function, the mother is involved in some community enterprise, and people don't live where they live anymore. This idea of the family unit just isn't there, and therefore, we have to hit the persons in a way where they are, in a sort of a running situation. There's a minister who, for instance, has services or Bible studies and so forth on the commuter trains that come into New York City.
On the actual train.
On the actual train. Because here he has an opportunity. That's the only opportunity probably that he has a chance to get all these men together. You know, the men's club is no longer in existence in the church, or it isn't too significant. And so here he has an opportunity, creatively and with sensitivity, to develop something that he feels is relevant to these men, and has an opportunity to talk to them on the way and right on the commuter train.
John, I have a caller
from
WBAL, a listener.
Another one from Baltimore?
Another one from Baltimore.
Good.
Mr. Harry Price. Hello, Harry. Speak right up, sir. You're on night call.
Hello, sir.
Yes, sir. Your comment.
When I was a young boy in the catechetical class in the Lutheran church, in the service, we used to take part reading maybe the Episcopal or the Collect or something of this nature. Now, I transferred to another Lutheran church down here. It just dawned on me that in recent years we don't do this.
What did you do in catechism? I didn't quite get that.
Down here in the New Lutheran Church that we transferred to, we don't do this. Is this the general...
You don't do what?
The young people taking over reading the Episcopal or the Collect in the church.
Yes.
Now, is this a practice of the Lutheran religion all over, or is this just something that's done by the individual pastor of the church?
You mean that now they are doing it and they didn't do it before?
No, they did do it before, and now they're not.
Oh, I see. I think that this has a lot to do, sir, with the individual pastor, you know. And I think that, of course, usually this is done on, when you say, Youth Sunday. And then the youth take over the reading of the service. Sometimes they even have one of the youngsters perhaps even preach a sermon, which has been prepared partly by the pastor. Now, there is a movement afoot, the involvement of the laity, because we're in a church which believes in the priesthood of all believers, and where there's a total involvement, and there's a great stress in having the lay people participate in the service. For instance, the church in which I was the former pastor, we have a lay reader, a person who reads the lessons you know, he's up in the chancel with the pastor, and he reads from the Bible. And more today, there is this participation of the lay people in many different denominations in the worship service itself. I think this does have something to do with the congregation and the individual pastor, but I would certainly encourage it. And here's something that you can do by talking it over with a pastor and saying, gee, I'd like to see, for instance, the youth perhaps participate in some way in the service more than just simply being the acolytes.
Well, Reverend, we have to break our stations now. Harry, I want to thank you for calling Night Call, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for your comments. Mr. Harry Price from Baltimore, Maryland,
a listener on WBAL with a rather interesting observation on church as it was in his youth and today at a new church that he's attending. Our guest tonight, Reverend John Gensel. Our topic, are Protestant church services sterile? You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
Well, you see, here's what happened. I was just starting to pass the car ahead of me, and then he suddenly swung out and tried to pass the car ahead of him. I guess he never saw me. And that's when it happened.
Famous last words. I guess he never saw me. Now, the point is, as long as you saw him, accidents like that don't have to happen. Remember, safety first begins between the ears. Now, maybe you can't expect everybody to drive as well as you, but you can at least watch out for those who don't. You can watch out for their mistakes and sudden moves, like professional drivers do. For example, before passing another car on the highway, flash your lights or sound your horn. Let them know you're coming. Don't rely on other drivers to see you and keep out of your way. So protect yourself by driving defensively. Remember, nearly half the drivers in fatal accidents are in the right. So just being in the right is not enough. You could be dead right. So watch out for the other guy.
This is Night Call, and here is host Russ Gibb.
Our guest tonight on Night Call, Reverend John Gensel, and he's a missionary to the jazz community of New York City. Our topic, are Protestant church services sterile? If you'd like to join us here at Night Call, our lines are now open, and we'd like to hear your comments about church services, whether or not you think they're sterile. The number to call us at, area code 313-846-6601. Now, you may call from anywhere collect. Please make the call station to station. The number is area code 313-846-6601. And I'd like to invite you also to drop a note for future topics that we might have here on Night Call. In other words, if you have a topic that you'd like to hear us discuss on Night Call or have a guest, just put this in letter form and send it to Night Call in care of the station into which you're listening. And we'll see if we can get that topic for you. Reverend John Gensel, tell me this. Why don't we have more rock and roll in our church services? Now, you've been talking about jazz, and it's my feeling that jazz is actually outdated today, that the majority of young people go much more for rock and roll than they do for jazz.
Well, I would say, Russ, that it is not dated, but you're absolutely right in saying that today's young people, for the most part, know and play more rock and roll than they do jazz. Now, let me just, before I start defending jazz or talking about that, let me say that in England, a Presbyterian church in Bristol, St. James Presbyterian Church, actually took this the rock and roll and made a whole service out of it. It's called A Man Dies, and I happened to talk with Ernest Marvin, the minister of that church, when he was over here, about the whole thing, and I saw the picture. There's an album out of this music. And it was written by the teenagers and for the teenagers of St. James Presbyterian Church.
And did they attend that service?
Well, now, here's what happened, that although for many years some of them attended the evening service, it became obvious to them and to others that the worship was hardly touching them at all. It's exactly the sort of thing we were talking about. In other words, the service was sterile. And somebody said, well, that A Man Dies is written as a gimmick to attract teenagers to church. In this particular case, it was written because they were already there. But they wanted to show that the Bible is as relevant to our lives today as it was in the early church.
Now, what happened to the old-timers, the older people in the church? Did they do a 180 and beat it out?
Many of them came and appreciated a great deal. And the play was presented in modern dress. You know, not put on the shepherd garb and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Modern dress. And they did it because it was relevant to them. And a man dies, even for today, is for and about people who are able to see and to read the Bible, but see no reason why they should at all.
Of course, this is the exception rather than the rule, isn't it?
Yeah, I just simply want to mention that to indicate that there has been experimentation in this area, and a man dies, done by the young people within the rock and roll beat and so forth, had a great... Well, they use, for instance, Jack the Knife and other songs in it, which they develop, How Long, Lordy, and it was very relevant to their needs. Now, I would say that rock and roll can be used to a great extent today in the church, and I would say that creatively, what the youth can do in any church, in any denomination, is to take the medium that they know best and work from that. Now, I feel that eventually, we graduate, I feel, from rock and roll when we become a little bit more creative.
Right.
Towards jazz and towards something that is much more stimulating, not only to the body but to the mind as well, and a little bit more creative than rock and roll. But I would say, rather than putting rock and roll down, or putting the Beatles down, for instance, who are excellent performers and who have a great deal to say for today, rather than putting them down and saying, look, I'll have nothing to do with it and so forth, is to start right where they are. There certainly isn't anything wrong with it, per se.
Well, are most Protestant churches doing this today?
No, they're not at all. They're not at all. And again, it's because they're in the straitjacket of traditionalism, and they've put the church aside from the world rather than being involved in it, to the point that they think that anything like this is terrible and sacrilegious and so forth, and I don't feel it is at all. I feel it start where the youth is.
Do you think that emotionalism has any place in the church?
I know it certainly has. For instance, Russ, if we think of the great events in life, your life and in my life, we become terribly emotionally involved. We think of birth and marriage and love and death. We don't do this in a cool way and we say, well, a friend of mine just died. We're all wrought up. Our entire body and mind and spirit is involved in it. And if the church worship is supposed to be the peak of my activity in worshiping the Lord, then it should involve the totality of my body. And this is one of the great things we get from the Old Testament. The man is a total man, and not just simply a mind or a soul and so forth. He's a totality.
Well, then emotionalism does have a place in the service.
I think it has a place in it, definitely.
But it's sort of been drained out. It's been strained out.
Well, it has been drained out, and again, if people think, well, if you get emotional in church, or maybe tap your foot a little bit, or snap your fingers, that this is completely out of place, as though you're supposed to be involved in some way intellectually, but it really in no sense with you, the totality of your being. And if a church service doesn't involve you totally, then I think it's just speaking to part of you. And then, again, the service itself, the worship service, doesn't have too much to do with my everyday activity. For instance, when Jesus instituted the sacraments, the sacrament of baptism, the sacrament of the Lord's Supper, it was the eternal in the common. There isn't anything more common than bread, than water for baptism, most of wine.
But now, again, that to the average kid today and the average individual today, you're talking about bread and wine, and it's pretty hard for him to conceive this type of idea.
It may be, but again, I don't think we should, Russ, in a sense, and here I'm going to speak on the other side now, put down our youth in the fact that they can't think, or that everything has to be so completely simple for them that unless we give it to them in a platter and digest it for them as honey, that they won't accept it.
Well, now, the word sacrament, is there another word that could be used for sacrament that means the same thing?
Well, I suppose that there is. Now, here again, we have, I would say that It's the Lord, the sacrament, has to do with God communicating himself to us in through his the elements, his grace, his love.
Well, why can't you say that today they say, talk to me?
Yeah,
to a kid just says, talk to me. You're
Lord
talking to me. I'm reading you.
Yeah,
why can't they say it this
way?
Way
that we can well, again, here again, we come into a great era. I wish we had a little more time to talk about this. And I'm trying to say something here which it may not be too intelligent, but I think it's very, very important, Russ, and that is that the mystery in life is so very vital and important. And I think in trying to communicate, we mustn't, in a sense, take away the great mysterium of life, that precisely we can't always explain these things in simple terms, because really they're not that simple, and that there is a great aspect to our life which is a mystery, which can draw us towards God as well as perhaps take us away from him. Mystery can draw us towards him as well as take us away.
John, we have a caller, and I think if we hurry, we can just have time for him. It's Mr. Harry Fox from Baltimore, Maryland, listener on WBAL.
Yes.
Harry, we have about a minute and a half. Sir, can you make your comment in that time?
Oh.
Yes, sir. Speak up. Harry?
Yes.
Can you, your comment, sir?
All right. I wanted to make mention that I've been interested in church music for quite a few years. And, it's always been my impression that the lyrics or the text of the music was the most important thing. That the music itself was secondary text.
John, what do you think about that?
In other words, you're saying that the text itself is the most important?
Yes.
And that the music... Yes, I think that this certainly is true, generally speaking. That is a proclamation of the word verbally. But I would like to say that the music itself is not only utilitarian, where you can use it only in reference to the verbalization, but that there is, to a great extent, revelation itself in the music, and that this is an area that I feel we have to explore a great deal.
Reverend, our time is up. Harry, I want to thank you for calling Night Call. Mr. Harry Fox, a listener on WBAL in Baltimore, Maryland. Reverend John Gensel, I want to thank you for being our guest here tonight.
Well, Russ, it's been wonderful.
Our topic tonight was, Are Protestant Church Services Sterile?
Tomorrow night on Night Call, our guest will be Dr. George Maddock. Our topic, Why Do Teenagers Drink? Until then, this is Gibb wishing you good luck and Godspeed.
Night Call is produced by the Methodist Church in cooperation with the National Council of Churches and this radio station. As a radio forum dedicated to the frank discussion of vital issues of daily life. Night Call encourages its participants to express freely and responsibly their own personal opinions.